At this time, I want to introduce our presenters for today, Tim Cregan, Bruce, and Debbie Kaplan at this time. Go ahead, you have the microphone.
Welcome. This is slide 11. This is Deborah Kaplan from the Department of Health and Human Services. This webinar is part of a series, Best Practices in Federal Section 508 Implementation. Other presentations of past webinars can be viewed at http://www.adaconferences.org/cioc/archive. And some of the very early ones are at https://efedlink.org/allqual/resource-shared-webinars.cfm. A best practice is a policy, process, procedure, or technique proven effective over time and repeatable by multiple agencies. A best practice is generalized so that diverse agencies may use it in their own organizations, but specific enough to provide useful guidance and instruction. The CIO Council's Accessibility Community of Practice has published a library of federal 508 best practices at www.section508.gov. Next slide, slide 12. This webinar is part of a series we're doing this year focusing on the new Section 508 standards. Webinar dates are bi-monthly during 2007. This is the March one. We've already held the January one. And the remainder will be in May, July, September, and November. They'll all focus on the 508 refresh. The next one in May, on May 30th, will focus on the topic of old versus new original Section 508 standards from 2000 compared to the revised Section 508 standards in 2017. The time is always from 1 to 2:30 p.m. Eastern Time, and I've already given you the website where you can find the archives. Next slide. Slide 13. This webinar is brought to you by the CIO Council, Accessibility Community of Practice, and the U.S. Access Board. Next slide. Slide 14. This webinar focuses on WCAG 2.0 and the revised Section 508 standards. Our presenters are Bruce Bailey, IT Accessibility Specialist, and Tim Cregan, Senior Accessibility Specialist, both at the U.S. Access Board. And I am turning it over to Tim.
Thank you, Debbie.
Thank you, Debbie. This is Tim Cregan of the U.S. Access Board, and we're on slide 15, which is today's agenda. So in the course of today's presentation, we have the welcome and introduction, which Debbie has just done, and then we're going to cover examples of gaps addressed by WCAG 2.0. Then we're going to talk about how the revised Section 508 standards incorporate WCAG 2.0. After that, we'll talk about requirements in the new standards that are essentially unchanged, and we'll talk about requirements from the original Section 508 standards from 2000, which have no direct equivalents in WCAG. We'll finish up with a brief list of resources, and then we will go to the question and answer session. As Claudia said, there is a chat box in the lower left-hand corner of your screen. Please enter your questions in that chat box. Those questions which we do not have time to answer today, Great Lakes will forward to us and we can respond at that time. So with that, I'm going to move on to our next slide, slide 16. This is one of the title slides, and this is examples of gaps addressed by WCAG 2.0. Now what these are going to be examples of accessibility issues that are not well addressed by the original Section 508 standards, but that are addressed in the revised 508 standards by the incorporation of WCAG. Now, I want to warn everybody that this going forward is going to be very much a tag team effort between Bruce Bailey and myself. I'm going to be the voice for 508 standards from the 2000, and Bruce is going to be the voice of the future. He is going to be the voice of the revised 508 standards from 2017. All right, are we ready? And we're off. Slide 17, problem, low contrast text. Okay, in the original Section 508 provisions, 1194.21J for software, all it says is you shall provide a variety of color selections capable of producing a range of contrast levels. Okay, so first of all, this is scoped only to software, not web, not documents. It's ambiguous. It's not very sufficiently testable because there's no measurable criteria provided. It doesn't tell you what the variety of color selections is. What does that mean? And unfortunately, because of that, you might not achieve your objective, which is with a range of contrast levels, there's the possibility that none of those levels would provide sufficiently high contrast. What if you have contrast of a bunch of different shades of gray, you know, 50 shades of gray? How much accessibility you're going to get for that? And finally, this provision is only required if a product permits a user to adjust the color and contrast settings. Moving on to the next slide, slide 18.
So, this is Bruce. As Tim said, I'll be the ghost of Christmas past here with the WCAG 2.0 success criteria as incorporated by reference in the 2017 revised standards. And what we have with WCAG success criteria 143 is a minimum requirement for contrast that the visual presentation of text and images of text have a contrast ratio of at least 4.5:1, except for large text, incidental text, and logo types. But basically, it's a minimum value from a mathematical formula for calculating the contrast ratio between foreground colors and background colors. And if you're designing a web page or a document or software, you will know because you have to program them. You will know those hexadecimal or values for foreground and background color, and so you can do the formula. And it's very helpful to have, well, it's critically important to have this kind of requirement in the accessibility standards because poor contrast is a very big impediment to using web pages and software and documents. And I have an example here of text going from black to white asking, does this text contrast with the white background? Having a number, we can pick out where the contrast is finally too poor. It also gets a suggestion here about not using red text on a white background, which would actually fail against the minimum contrast ratio of 4.5:1. Even with a range of contrast ranges of reds, red is a difficult color for many people. But the nice thing about the mathematical formula that WCAG 2.0 uses is that you don't have to worry about particular types of color blindness, red, green, different shades of brown or yellow or orange, because the formula takes into account all of those. You can just plug in your foreground, your color, your background color, and you know if you've got a high enough contrast or not. You don't have to worry about reds, you don't have to worry about greens, all of that. It's very, very usable. We'll go on to the next slide.
Okay, this is Tim again. We're back to slide 19. Okay, the problem here is called meaningful sequence. Now, the original Section 508 standards do not have a requirement to address meaningful sequence.
So, I mean, you know, the linearized reading order is definitely a significant issue, and it's great that WCAG 2.0 has a success criteria, 132. When the sequence in which content is presented affects its meaning, a correct reading sequence can be programmatically determined. And the example here is some newspaper-style text where the intent is for the text to read down one column and to the bottom of the column, and then to this, to the next column. And I'll start read you a sample of what I'm using here. 80 and 7 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation or any nation so conceived and so dedicated can long endure. Let's go to the next slide. What happens with assistive technology? Slide 20. If the assistive technology reads across the columns instead of down the columns, like you would expect. 80 and 7 years ago, so dedicated can long endure. Our fathers brought forth on this. We are met on a great battlefield continent, a new nation conceived of that war. We have come in liberty and dedicated to the dedicated portion of that field as proposition that all men are a final resting place for those created equal. Wow, that is just terrible. So you can see that this is, you know, having a correct reading sequence is quite important to accessibility. Next slide. So now I'm going to give an example of incorrect language. Another requirement that's in WCAG 2.0, there's a requirement for language of page that the default human language of each web page can be programmatically determined. And a 3.1.2, language of part that the human language of each passage or phrase and content can be programmatically determined. And we have a nice example here of why this is so important. So I'm going to give you that that little passage is read by, spoken aloud by a screen reading speech synthesis software. If you would, please
follow. At this time, the system will launch the MP3 file on your local player. So it will take a second before it starts to play. Launching at this time. The MP3 file has finished.
So that is actually a pretty high quality speech synthesis. It's actually much, much slower than most people that use assistive technology would play their speech synthesis in, but it is using the absolutely the correct English pronunciation rules. Now it's a bigger, we're going to listen to the same phrase, the same passage, but now it's going to be spoken using rules for French pronunciation, and I dare you to follow along. Go ahead, please, Claudia.
Launching now. MP3 has concluded.
So I find that audio clip completely unintelligible, and I've listened to it any number of times. If I don't have the words in front of me, I absolutely cannot discern what's going on there. And I'm fairly used to listening to speech synthesis. The problem of listening to English with French pronunciation rules is very similar to the problem that somebody who reads and speaks Spanish listening to Spanish text read with English pronunciation rules, or English text with Spanish pronunciation rules. It's so if you're blind using a screen reader and you work in multilingual documents, this is absolutely a pretty severe requirement for retaining your job, and it's quite important and appropriate that WCAG 2.0 catch that as an accessibility barrier. So ready to go on to slide 22, please. Next slide.
Okay, this is Tim back with another problem. Size test. Okay, the original 508 standards from 2000 do not have a technical requirement to support font resizing.
In WCAG 2.0, there's with success criteria 144, this requires that text can be resized without assistive technology up to 200% without loss of content or functionality. Again, a very basic impediment to using a web page, a basic requirement for accessibility, and not something that's addressed in the original 508 standards. Most browsers will provide a zoom features, but it's still an important requirement, and it's still possible to write different types of web content and documents in ways that interferes with any zoom feature that might be built into your player or your web browser. And we have some examples here, w3.org/WAI. They explain how their websites and their resources natively support the text size of your web browser. ncd.gov, the National Council on Disabilities, they have a very nice widget that lets users select your preferred font size, font type, and color choices. And then the other example we have here is google.com/advanced_search, which is it's a complicated web form or a web application, if you will. It's certainly got a number of fields in it, and it works well with browser zoom. Next slide, slide 23.
Thank you. We have autoplay sound, the problem. The original Section 508 standards do not prohibit or limit music or other sound effects that apply automatically. So this can interfere with screen reading software, and it can disorient some people with certain cognitive disabilities.
In WCAG 2.0, we have a requirement with success criteria 1.4.2 that requires user control over audio that would automatically play otherwise. Most people have encountered this at some point. You go to a website and some music starts playing, maybe part of a commercial or advertisement or a video that's automatically playing. So it's a kind of thing that most people find annoying. But for some people, it's absolutely blocking. If you can't get to your screen reader controls because there's sounds playing, or you can't hear what the screen reader feedback you're getting, that's going to be a problem. And then some people are, with cognitive limitations certain disabilities, they're completely thrown off from what they were. So they've got a whole plan in mind for when they go to a web page, the thing starts playing. By the time they've got to shut up and stop talking, they've forgotten why they were interested in that web page in the first place. Next slide, please. Okay, these next series, I'm going to go through these a little bit more quickly. These are all new requirements in WCAG 2.0 that are not in 508, current original 508 at all. 133, sensory characteristics, that instructions are provided for understanding and operating content do not rely solely on sensory characteristics of components such as size, shape, visual location, orientation, or sound. So it's similar to the current requirement in WCAG and 508 to not only use color, this is don't only use visual sensory indicators. 323, consistent notification, something again that's useful for everybody, absolutely blocking for people that are using, or much more blocking for people that are using assistive technology like screen reading, and for people with certain cognitive disabilities, it's very disorienting. That if you have a navigation mechanism that are repeated on multiple web pages within a set of web pages, that the pages the navigation mechanism occur in the same relative order each time they're repeated, unless a change is initiated by the user. So keeping those menus in the same order from page to page, obviously a very sensible, logical thing to do, but critical for some. Next slide, 25, please. This group is organized in WCAG as provide ways to help users navigate, find content, and determine where they are. 243, focus order. If a web page can be navigated sequentially and the navigation sequence affects meaning or operation, focusable components receive focus in an order that preserves meaning and operability. Very reasonable thing to expect out of your web page. So if you're tabbing through the web page just to see what's going on, that the tab order is in a way that preserves meaning and operability. 244, link purpose and context. The purpose of each link can be determined from the link text alone or from the link text together with its programmatically determined link content, except where the purpose of the link would be ambiguous to users in general. So the link inside a list or inside a sentence, maybe or inside a paragraph, those are all ways to provide some context to the purpose of the link. So this would be a prohibition, thank you, against having multiple click heres on a web page. 245, multiple ways. More than one way is available to locate web page within a set of web pages, except where the web page is a result or step in a process. Since, you know, if you're going through an ordering process, you're not going to have, you have to do those pages in that order. But there's very many ways to do this, multiple ways. You could have a search function would be one way to do it. Having a sitemap is another way to do it. So this is not an onerous requirement, but it's nice to have it as an accessibility requirement. 246, headings and labels. That headings and labels describe the topic or purpose. Again, another one of these common sense kind of things. Why do you have headings and labels if they don't describe topic or purpose? But it's important to state this, again, for screen reader users who will use those headings and labels to get oriented, and people with cognitive limitations that really need those headings and labels to be purposeful. Next slide, please. Slide 26. We have a couple requirements, new requirements to help users correct mistakes. 333, error suggestion. If an input error is automatically detected and suggestions for correction are known, then the suggestions are provided to the user unless it would jeopardize the security or purpose of the content. So another thing that's nice to do and important enough to be now to be a requirement. 334, error prevention for legal, financial, or data. It's nice to have error prevention everywhere, but and actually error prevention is a AAA requirement, general error prevention, but in the level A and level AA's we have error prevention for legal, financial, and data information. So for web pages that cause legal commitments or financial transactions for the user to occur, that modify or delete user-controllable data in data storage systems, or that submit user test responses, at least one of the following is true: that submissions are reversible, that data entered by the user is checked for input errors and the user is provided an opportunity to correct them, or three, confirmed the mechanism is available for reviewing, confirming, and correcting the information before finalizing the submission. Next slide, 27, and the last one in this set of new things that we get out of WCAG 2 that aren't in original 508 year 2000 is 411 parsing. In content implemented using markups languages, that elements have complete start and end tags. Elements are nested according to their specification. Elements do not contain duplicate attributes, and any ID values are unique, except where the specification allows these features. And this is this bad syntax is an important requirement because these types of syntax errors are basically masked or glossed over visually by web browsers, but they can very much interfere with the behavior of screen reading software and other assistive technology. And so with that, I will go back to Tim, slide 28.
Yes, here we are on slide 28. This is a change of topic. Now, this is just a little brief interlude where we talk about how the revised Section 508 standards incorporate WCAG 2.0. So moving on to slide 29. Slide 29 is called WCAG 2.0 Incorporation by Reference, or IBR. So when we talk about IBR, that's our shorthand, meaning that the WCAG standard is incorporated within the Section 508 standards and 255 guidelines. We have a large circle on this slide, and the circle is the universe of the 508 standards and the 255 guidelines. It is those rules in their entirety. A little subset of this bigger rule are the WCAG 2.0 success criteria and conformance requirements. Those for level A and level AA. Those are contained within the 508-255 rule. On the outside, as it were, are the WCAG AAA success criteria, which are not included in the revised rule. Moving on to the next slide, we're presenting essentially the same information in text. So slide 30, WCAG 2.0 is now incorporated by reference, IBR, into the revised Section 508 standards. of Level A and Level AA success criteria, or SC, provide the requirements and the metrics. And then the citations also include the WCAG 2.0 conformance requirements. These are all part of the new Section 508 revised standards. Now, for those of you who want to check, we have references to WCAG 2.0 Level AA appearing four times. As applied to electronic content and software, that will be found in 508, Chapter 2, Scoping. Those of you who saw last January presentation, where we talked about the structure, remember we have Chapters 1 and 2 in this rule are application and scoping. So the scoping chapter is where you always go to find out what applies to your ICT. And so in Chapter 508, Chapter 2 Scoping, it talks about WCAG being applied to electronic content and to software. Then there's an exception for web applications, which is discussed in Chapter 5, software. And then there's an electronic support documentation provision in Chapter 6. Let's go to the next slide and see what those citations are. We're on slide 31. And so the actual citations to WCAG 2.0, which are found in the 508 text, 508 Chapter 2, it's provision E205.4, Accessibility Standard. This is found under the larger section of E205, which covers all of electronic content. So E205.4 is a child of the parent provision, E205. And it says that WCAG will be the accessibility standard that is applied to electronic content. Similarly, E207.2, WCAG conformance, appears under the parent provision of E207 software, saying that this is what applies to software. In Chapter 5, the software chapter, provision 504 authoring tools contains the reference to WCAG 2.0. And in Chapter 6, the support documentation and services, you're looking at provision 602.3, which is electronic support documentation. Okay, now with that, we bring you on to the next slide of the presentation, slide 32, which is requirements that are essentially unchanged. These are ones that from the 508 from 2000 are essentially unchanged in the revised rule in 2017. Okay, let's begin. Okay, so first one, we're on slide 33, requirement for alternative text. In the original 508 standards from 2000, we have a provision in the web provisions, 1194.22a, I'm sure you can all recite this from memory, a text equivalent for every non-text element shall be provided. And then the examples are given via alt, line description, or an element context.
The revised 2017 standards referencing WCAG 2.0 get the same requirement from Success Criteria 1.1.1 for non-text content. All non-text content that is presented to the user has a text alternative that serves the equivalent purpose. So this part of the first opening part of 1.1.1 very much mirrors 1194.22a. We don't have the examples about alt or long desk because those are technology specific. They're specific to HTML. We just have the general idea that the text alternative serves the equivalent purpose. Now, 1.1.1 goes into quite a bit of greater detail because there's some examples that we know exactly what to do. Next slide, slide 34. So it goes on, except for the situations listed below. These situations of these particular uses of non-text content are addressed individually and a little bit differently. So for controls and input, there's a requirement that that the name of the control describes its purpose. And then guidelines 4.1.1 and 4.1.2 give some additional detail about controls and inputs. For time-based media, your multimedia, your videos with sound, there's a requirement for descriptive identification of a non-text content, and then requirements from 1.2.1 to 1.2.5 would be applicable. If the non-text content is a test or exercise that would be invalidated if presented in text, then text alternatives provide descriptive identification of the non-text content. And the example here is we have a spelling test where you couldn't very well have a picture of something and ask people to spell it and not and have the text equivalent give the spelling kind of thing. Sensory is another one of the fourth called out type, that if the non-text content is primarily intended to create a specific sensory experience, so for example, if it's, you know, just something you might see out your window, if it's a beach cam, if it's a, say, a music, instrumental music with no, you know, no speech, that you provide descriptive identification of the non-text content. And that all makes perfect sense, a picture being a, worth a thousand words kind of thing. We can't provide text equivalents for these kinds of sensory experiences. The fifth type of media that's called of non-text content is called out as CAPTCHA. CAPTCHA is the common way to tell the, for web pages to try and tell the difference between a human user and a scripting or a bot or a some sort of a machine scanning through the page. So the purpose of the non-text content is to affirm that the content's being accessed by a person and not a machine or a computer, that you've got the descriptive identification, and that you provide alternate modes of access that use different sensory experiences for the CAPTCHA. And finally, the last example is decorating, formatting, and visible, that if the non-text content is pure decoration and is used only for visual formatting, or it's not presented to all users, that it's implemented in a way that can be ignored by assistive technology. And that's also a very important thing, because you don't want the decorative images to be overly chatty. This is the typical example with the traditional web accessibility for this is alt equals quote quote. We're going to go to slide 35, please.
Thank you.
All right, this is the requirement for keyboard operation. In the original 508 standards, in the software provision, 21A says, when software is designed to run on a system that has a keyboard, product functions shall be executable from a keyboard where the function itself or the result of performing a function can be discerned textually.
The WCAG 2.0 requirement is very similarly worded in the beginning, at least. All functionality of the content is operable through a keyboard interface without requiring specific timing for individual keystrokes. The exception is a little differently. 1194.21a has an exception for except where the result of performing the function can be discerned textually. The exception in 2.1.1 is except where the underlying function requires input that depends on the path of the user's movement and not just the endpoints. So the understanding document for WCAG gives a couple of good examples of that. If you have like a helicopter flight simulator, that's not something that we're going to be able to provide keyboard controls for adequately. If you have a watercoloring application where depending on how hard you hold the stylus or press down on the stylus on the tablet, you get different hues of the color or different stroke thicknesses, that's also something you don't know how to emulate through a keyboard. So those two examples, 2.1.1 would not apply. Next slide, please.
Okay, we're on slide 36. Slide 36 is talking about requirements for no keyboard trap. Okay, this provision is intended to help users of AT. So it's a common problem with Flash. We're tabbing around the codes, the user gets into the Flash app and loses the focus. But original 508 standards have no requirement that addresses this.
So WCAG 2.0 gets us at 2.1.2. No keyboard trap. If keyboard focus can be moved to a component of the page using a keyboard interface, then focus can be moved away from that component. And then a little bit more details. Using only the keyboard interface, and if it requires more than unmodified arrow or tab keys or other standard exit method, the user is advised of the method for moving focus away. So typically, you could just tab around the screen, or maybe use arrow keys to navigate the screen. So if it's going to be something other than those two methods for getting out of the Flash object or the component that took the keyboard focus, that you have to let the user know ahead about that kind of thing ahead of time. We could have covered this in our first part of our segment where we were talking about things that are new. Many people would consider this as being part of keyboard accessibility. I mean, if your keyboard gets stuck, that's not keyboard accessible. Next slide, please.
Okay, slide 37, the requirement to not use color alone. Now, original 508 has two provisions, one in software and one in web. The software provision is 1194.21i, and the web provision is 1194.22.2. Essentially, they're both getting to the idea that color coding shall not be used as the only means of conveying information, indicating an action, prompting a response, or distinguishing a visual element. And the web aspect of it, you should design your web pages so that the information conveyed with color is also available without color. For example, from the context or the markup of the page.
The revised 2017 standards incorporating WCAG 2.0 by reference, success criteria 1.4.1, use of color is almost verbatim to 1194.21i. Color is not used as the only visual means of conveying information, indicating an action, prompting a response, or distinguishing a visual element. Next slide, please.
Okay. Requirements to avoid inducing seizures. Again, the original Section 508 standards have two provisions, one for software, 1194.21k, and for web at 1194.22j. And in both cases, whether it's software or it's a web page, you do not want to have flashing or blinking text, objects, or other elements that have a flash or a blink frequency greater than 2 hertz and lower than 55 hertz. Similarly, you want web pages to avoid causing the screen to flicker with a frequency greater than 2 hertz and lower than 55 hertz.
WCAG 2.0, again being technology neutral, only has to say this requirement once with success criteria 2.3.1. It's a little bit more plain language. Instead of greater than 2 hertz, we just say more than flashes 3 times in any 1 second. Exactly, it's the same metric. Web pages do not contain anything that flashes more than 3 times in any 1 second, or the flash is below the general flash and red flash threshold. And those two things, the general flash and red flash thresholds, are described mathematically in detail in WCAG 2.0, the idea being that if the flash is small or dim, that it's not going to trigger a seizure either. So it's nice to have it not be overly prescriptive. Next slide.
Okay, slide 39. Requirement to use actual text, not pictures of text. In the original Section 508 standards for software, 1194.21f, textual information shall be provided through operating systems for displaying text.
The WCAG 2.0 success criteria 1.4.5, images of text is very, very similar again. If the technology being used can achieve the visual presentation, text is used to convey information rather than images of text. It has a couple important exceptions for if your images of text are customizable, that's allowed. If your images of text are essential, that's allowed as well. So from that perspective, original 508 was a little bit too constraining. Next slide, please.
Okay, slide 40. This is the requirement for SkipNav or similar. Original 508, 1194.22, web provision O. A method shall be provided that permits users to skip repetitive navigation links.
WCAG success criteria 241, bypass blocks, almost exactly the same except of just navigation links. We're just talking about blocks of content. It's a little bit more generalized. And it reads, a mechanism is available to bypass blocks of content that are repeated on multiple web pages. Next slide.
Slide 41, requirements for page titles. From Section 508.1194.22, the web provision 22i. Frames shall be titled with text that facilitates frame identification and navigation.
WCAG 2.0 success criterion 242, page title very similar, a little bit more general language again, not talking about frames, which is, again, web specific. Web pages have titles that describe topic or purpose. Next slide, please.
Slide 42, the requirement to provide users control over animation. Original 508 in the software provisions, 1194.21h, it says, when animation is displayed, the information shall be displayable in at least one non-animated presentation mode at the option of the user.
Reg 2.0, success criteria 2.2.2, pause, stop, hide. Again, very parallel, just goes into a little bit more detail. So we have two instances for moving, blinking, scrolling, or updating, auto-updating information. All of the following are true. And then for moving, blinking, or scrolling, any moving, blinking, or scrolling information that starts automatically and lasts more than 5 seconds and is presented in parallel with other content, that there is a mechanism for the user to pause, stop, or hide, unless the movement, blinking, scrolling is part of an activity where it is essential. Or the second use case is auto-updating. For any auto-updating information that starts automatically and is presented in parallel with other content, that there is a mechanism for the user to pause, stop, or hide, or control the frequency of the updates, unless the auto-updating is part of an activity where it is essential. Next slide, please.
Okay, this is slide 43. The requirement to provide users enough time to read and use the content. This is a web provision from an original 508. It's 1194.22p. When a timed response is required, the users shall be alerted and given sufficient time to indicate more time is required.
And again, WCAG 2.0 success criteria 2.2.1, timing adjustable, is again parallel to the 22P requirement, again going into more detail. So it reads, for each time limit that is set by the content, at least one of the following is true: turn off, that the user is allowed to turn off the time limit before encountering; adjust, that the user is allowed to adjust the time limit before encountering it, and they're able to adjust it over a wide range that is at least 10 times the length of the default setting; or three, extend, the user is warned before time expires and given at least 20 seconds to extend the time limit with a simple action, for example, press the space bar, and also that the user is allowed to extend the time limit at least 10 times. And then we have three exceptions for when 2.2.1 is not applicable. Real-time exception, if the time limit is part of a real-time event, for example, an auction, then no alternative to the time limit is possible. Or the essential exception, that the time limit is essential and extending it would invalidate the activity. Or the 20-hour exception, the time limit is longer than 20 hours. We're ready for the next slide. Slide 44, please.
Slide 44. These are the requirements for captioning and audio description. And what you have on the slide are two columns. One are the original 508 provisions, and on the opposite column are the corresponding WCAG 2.0 success criteria. So to start us off with 1194.22 in the web, you're talking about text equivalents for non-text elements.
So we already covered that for original 508, and then again with this example, WCAG 2.0 goes into a little bit more detail. So in success criterion 1.2.1, we have the specific requirements for pre-recorded audio only and pre-recorded video only. So that would be where you just have a sound snippet, or you just have an animation, for example, that doesn't have any sound. In those cases, you have to have a text equivalent, but again, that would be the same thing that would be the expectation, the requirement for original 508, 1194.22a.
Okay. Moving down the page, we're back in the original 508 provision column. We're talking about the provisions that address captioning. Now, the provisions are addressed in two areas. They're addressed under the web provisions, 1194.22b, and the multimedia provisions, which is 1194.24c. 1194.24c is the requirement that multimedia productions, which have audio content that is necessary for the comprehension of the content, must be captioned. And 1194.22b is the requirement that those captions must be synchronized with the audio.
So just because of the organization in WCAG 2.0, these get broken into two requirements. WCAG 2.0 has multiple levels, and it breaks out pre-recorded multimedia as level A and live multimedia as level 2, so the captioning requirement is in two places in WCAG 2.0, 1.2.2 for captions pre-recorded and 1.2.4 for captions live.
And now back to the 508 column again for multimedia. This last provision addresses the issue of the requirement for audio description. So we have 1194.22b and 1194.24d. 1194.24d is your requirement for multimedia that says that where the images in a multimedia production are necessary for the comprehension of content, that you have to auto-describe those images. And the 1194.22b requirement is saying that those audio descriptions must be synchronized with the images they're describing.
In WCAG 2.0, audio description is only applied to pre-recorded multimedia in 1.2.5. Next slide.
Okay.
So slide 45. These are the requirements for image math and data tables. Now, in original 508, under the web provisions, we have four provisions that are talking about image maps and data tables. They're provision E, F, G, and H. So provision E says that redundant text links shall be provided. Provision F says that client-side image maps will be provided. Provision G is telling us that row and column headers shall be identified for data tables. And finally, provision H is saying that markup shall be used for those data tables.
So those are all very specific to HTML elements. So in WCAG 2.0, they all be those four requirements end up being netted up with success criterion 1.3.1 info and relationship, that information structure and relationships conveyed through presentation can be programmatically determined or available in text. But if you go into the understanding documents associated with WCAG, you see the exact same things for client-side image maps and data tables described as ways to meet 1.3.1 as people have been doing to meet those four provisions of 1194.22. Next slide, please.
Okay, slide 46. This is the requirement for visual focus. So this is the software provision in the original 508 standards. It's provision 1194.21c. And it says that a well-defined on-screen indication of the current focus shall be provided that moves among interactive interface elements as the input focus changes. The focus shall be programmatically exposed so that assistive technology can track focus and focus changes.
The equivalent requirement in WCAG 2.0 is a little bit simpler and is a little bit more focused itself on just the keyboard focus. So success criterion 2.4.7, focus visible. Any keyboard operable user interface has a mode of operation where the keyboard focus is visible. Next slide.
Slide 47. This is the requirement for consistent use of icons. So this is really going to consistent meaning. In software 508, software provision 1194.21e, it says, when bitmap images are used to identify controls, status indicators, or other programmatic elements, the meaning assigned to those images shall be consistent throughout the application's performance.
Almost identical requirement in success criteria 3.2.4, just using a little bit more general language, consistent identification. Components that have the same functionality within a set of web pages are identified consistently. Next slide.
Okay, slide 48. Requirement for usable control when changing settings. Original 508 has two provisions in the software and in the web provisions. The software provision is 1194.21L. The web provision is 1194.22N. And they're both talking about electronic forms. The software provision is talking about when the forms are used. The web provision is talking about when those forms are designed to be completed online. And both of the provisions say that people using assistive technology shall be able to access the information, field elements, and functionality required for completion and submission of the form, including all directions and cues.
In WCAG 2.0, this is the close match to success criterion 3.2.2 on input. Changing the setting of any user interface component does not automatically cause a change of context unless the user has been advised of the behavior before using the component. If somebody's using the keyboard, maybe using screen reading software, they tap into the component. If it were to cause a change of trying to operate the component, trying to change the setting, if that moved the focus around, that electronic form would not be at all usable or accessible. Going on to the next slide.
This is slide 49. It's a requirement to help users avoid mistakes. So original section 508 has a software and a web provision for addressing this issue. The software provision 1194.21L and the web provision 1194.22. And I was talking about electronic forms. It's requiring that you include all directions and queues. Similarly, for the web provision, when the forms are designed to be completed online, you need to provide directions and queues for completing those forms.
So WCAG 2.0 breaks that direction and queue requirement into two success criteria. 3.3.1, error identification. If an input error is automatically detected, the item that is in the error is identified and the error is described to the user in text. And 3.3.2, labels or instructions. Labels or instructions are provided when the content requires user input. Next slide, please.
Okay, slide 50. Requirements for user interface components. Original 508.1194.21, this is a software requirement. 21D, it says sufficient information about a user interface element, including the identity, operation, and state of the element shall be available to assistive technology. When an image represents a program element, the information conveyed by the image must also be available in text.
Very similar requirement in WCAG 2.0, success criteria 4.1.2, name, role, value. For all user interface components, including but not limited to form elements, links, and components generated by scripts, the name and role can be programmatically determined. States, properties, and values that can be set by the user can be programmatically set. And notification of changes to these items is available to user agents, including assistive technology. All right, now we can move to our final portion of our formal program, slide 51.
Okay, this is the title slide. As Bruce said, this is the last section of material we're going to cover today. This is requirements from original section 508, which have no direct equivalents in WCAG 2.0. Moving on to slide 52.
So remember, WCAG 2.0 is applying to all technology. So WCAG, and since these next things are talking about specific types of web technologies, we're not going to find parallels to them in the original in WCAG.
Okay, so original 508 in the web provisions 1194.22, there's three provisions in particular we're going to call out, and we're going to discuss them for a moment. Provision D, which says that documents shall be organized so they're readable without requiring an associated style sheet. Provision L, when pages utilize scripting languages to display content or to create interface elements, the information provided by the script shall be identified with functional text that can be read by assistive technology. And then finally, provision M, when a web page requires that an applet, plugin, or other application be present on the client system to interpret page content, the page must provide a link to a plugin or applet that complies with the software provisions 1194.21A through L. So these are three of the provisions from original 508 in web which are not found in WCAG 2.0. Let's go to the next slide and see why that is. Slide 53. Why did we drop these technology-specific requirements in original 508.1194.22 from the web provisions?
So this, this discussion is also reflected in the proposed rule, not the final rule, but in the preamble to the proposed rule. In Part 3, Major Issues, B4, we go into detail about this. And this is also supported by with the in the development of WCAG 2.0 from WCAG 1.0, that readable without a that style sheets, taking away that 1194.22D, would be counterproductive because cascading style sheets are well supported by assistive technology, and they're useful for everyone, including people that use assistive technology. So it's very much accessibility supported, very much promotes accessibility. CSS does, that is, cascading style sheets. Similarly with L, JavaScript really can't just be reduced to a single requirement about functional text. As JavaScript has evolved, it's not realistic to have one and only one requirement. So all of WCAG 2.0 applies to the whole page, including any JavaScript that's used on that page. So you apply all of WCAG 2.0 to the use of JavaScript on the web page, just like you would everything else that's on the web page. and M is similar, about providing there's no reason to have a link to the plugin that's accessible when we're requiring that the whole page be accessible. And also, as web pages have evolved, it's really not even possible to decide or tell when a plugin or applet is coming into place. It's really a matter of how you've got your browser configured and, you know, what plugins you have. I mean, back in the day, there was only one PDF reader. Now there's several that might be available, and it's all user preference. So all of WCAG applies to the whole page, including any use of plugins and applets. And WCAG works, there's the W3C has, I think it's up to hundreds of PDF techniques documented, and WCAG applies perfectly well to the PDF type of technology. Again, it's technology neutral. All right, going to the next slide, please.
Okay. This is slide 54. The issue here is multiple versions of web pages are still permitted, but it's not an explicit provision anymore. So in original 508, in the web provision 1194.22k, we had the requirement, which could be controversial, which says a text-only page with equivalent information or functionality shall be provided to make a website comply with the provisions of this part, when compliance cannot be accomplished in any other way. The content of the text-only page shall be updated whenever the primary page changes.
So there's no success criteria like that in WCAG 2.0. There is a similar idea in that WCAG 2.0 allows for what is defined as a conforming ultimate version. And please see the WCAG 2.0 conformance requirements for the detailed requirements of what makes a conforming alternate version. And in particular, we know here that it would be really hard for a text-only page to satisfy the definition of a conforming alternate version. Because if I have a Word document or a PDF document or some sort of web application where I've got, you know, headings and emphasized text with italics and bold, or I've got any kind of interactivity, none of those kinds of things are possible to represent adequately in plain text. So that plain ASCII text-only page would not satisfy the definition of conforming alternate versions. And again, I want to emphasize the title here that you are permitted multiple versions. It's great if you've got multiple versions and every single version is accessible, but current 508 allows you to have an accessible web page right alongside an inaccessible PDF. We don't like to, you know, advertise that too heavily, but if you go to the acquisition FAQs or other resource documents, it talks about that. That's basically the same idea as a conforming alternate version. One version needs to be fully accessible. Next slide. So slide 55, I want to mention a few quick reminders about WCAG 2.0. This is not a training on WCAG 2.0. We have one of our webinars up. There's lots of information available about WCAG 2.0. But as you go look at WCAG 2.0, I want to remind you folks that the techniques are not required, but they provide lots of guidance, lots of technical assistance. The success criteria are the requirements. The success criteria are the things that you should look in your checklists, you should look in your voluntary product accessibility templates, in your government product accessibility templates. Those are the requirements. The built-in, one of the nice features of WCAG is that it does have this built-in prioritization path or a plan for development, a plan for remediation, a way to do quality assurance. Because you have the breakdown between level A and level AA, if you're new to accessibility, it's perfectly reasonable to focus on the A things before you get to the AA things. And there's also those four success criteria that have notes about non-interference. Those are really complete blockers, showstoppers for people using assistive technology coming to your pages. And then it's also a great feature that the AAA success criteria are right in line with the AA and the double and the single A and the AA success criteria. The AAA success criteria, as Tim and I have mentioned a few times here, those are not required under 508, but hey, they're nice things to do. They do improve accessibility. They are important for many people, and it's nice to have those features available right alongside the things that are requirements. And then finally, I'll conclude by mentioning that the WCAG 2.0 supporting documents are regularly updated. WCAG 2.0, stable, not changing, hasn't been touch since 2008. It's a stable, finalized standard, but the technical assistance materials are refreshed on a six-month schedule. So there's always being more resources that, or more details added to that. That will go to slide 6, please.
Okay, this is Deborah Kaplan again. Just checking, is my mic on?
Yes, it is.
Okay, thank you. We will now give you some information about resources, so we'll go to the next slide. This is slide 57. So for more details, we suggest you spend some time reading the preamble to the final rule. There's a lot of information there explaining why choices were made and why different rules are the way they are. And then there's also information, a table, A1, that looks at the WCAG 2.0 level A and level AA success criteria compared to section 508. And the notice of proposed rulemaking also includes a comparison table of WCAG 2.0 comparing it to the existing 508 standards. You can find the NPRM at www.access-board.gov/WCAG2-508. Next slide. Slide 59. So the information I just talked about, that you can find out more about the final rule, is found at the Access Board's website, www.access-board.gov. You can find the actual standards, guidelines, technical assistance. You can find webinars, the ones that are archived of this webinar series. And there's more guidance material currently under development, both technical guidance as well as operational guidance, business processes that federal agencies and others can use for implementing the new standards. Also, section 508.gov is a fantastic site for very useful information, and we'd especially like to point out there's WCAG harmonized guidance from the Accessible Electronic Document Community of Practice, the AEDCOP, and there you can find guidance about specific document formats, such as Word and PDF, at http://section508.gov/best-practices. Next slide, please. And we're going to go directly to questions because we've gotten several, and we'd like to just go right to that and give enough time for your questions and our answers. So let's just move to that. So you can type and submit questions in the chat area text box. Several of you have already done that, or press Control M and enter text in the chat area. And let me go through the ones that came in a little earlier. So one question had to do with the questioner has heard that the Web Accessibility Initiative, which develops WCAG 2.0, is working on the next version, WCAG 2.1. And what does that mean for these standards? What should agencies do about that?
Thank you, Debbie. This is Tim. I'll start off and Bruce can jump in. Okay, so the important thing to remember is when we have a government standard and we make a reference to an existing standard, we always refer to that standard, a specific edition. We identify it by date. So in this case, when you look at the 508 standards, you go to Chapter 7, which is where all the standards incorporated by reference are found. And you will see that the version of WCAG that we were referring to is WCAG 2.0 that was published in 2008. So that is unchanged. So agencies should go forward using WCAG 2.0 from 2008. Now you're asking what we should do with regard to WCAG 2.1. WCAG 2.1 is the next iteration of WCAG in the process, which is intended to fill in some of the spaces, some of the missing areas from existing WCAG 2.0. For example, they are working on provisions to address cognition. This is not a finalized standard. It is very much a work in progress, and as such, you cannot reference a work in progress. You may use some of the information for informational purposes, but in terms of what you refer to when you're making your decisions, you look to the WCAG 2.0 standard.
I have almost nothing to add to that. Yes, it's true. There's a first call working draft for WCAG 2.1. Very much want to encourage people to pay attention and contribute to that process. But as Tim said, it doesn't affect 508 at all. And, you know, it's going to be, it'll probably be at least a year before 2.1 is finalized, if not longer. And then if 508 wants to adopt that, that would be a whole other comment and response period. So, it's an interesting thing, but it doesn't affect the 508 requirements.
Okay, thank you. So let me ask one question that just came in that I think is important. When will these rules become enforceable?
Okay, this is Tim. All right, so remember, in the slideshow, we referred you to the Access Board website, and we referred you to the final rule, which is posted on our website. So the final rule will become enforceable after January 18th of 2018. Now, remember, these rules were published on January 17th of this year. They became effective on March 21st of this year. Effective meaning that they came into existence, but they're not required to be followed until after January 18th of this next year, 2018.
I want to encourage folks to take a look at the webinar from 2 months ago. Tim, if you've got the exact date, we did that March.
January 31st.
Thank you, and then we repeated it on
February 2nd.
So where we think we've answered those questions pretty well, but very important in there is I'll call it a generous clause for legacy ICT, safe harbor clause. So if your website's, you're a federal entity, your website conforms to the original year 2000 508 standards, you're not required to update things until you update your content. So please take a look at that and absolutely write us, email us if that doesn't answer your question.
And this is Tim again. Just to pick up on what Bruce just said, because I noticed one of the questions asked about this, and we actually did cover this in the previous webinar, legacy ICT is one of the general exceptions in the revised 508 standards, and it's found under E202.2, which means that's in Chapter 2 of the 508 scoping chapter. It's Chapter 2, E202.2, Legacy ICT. And the definitions within Legacy ICT that are relevant are the definition of what is an alteration, which is found at E103.4, and what is existing ICT, which is also found in the definitions. So I'll refer you to that. Thank you.
Okay. So a very specific question, does the keyboard focus requirement apply to mobile devices that don't have a tactile keyboard?
Oh, that was I saw that one come in. That's a great question. I don't think they were asking about just keyboard focus. They were asking about the keyboard accessibility. And what you need to do is take a look at what the note that's attached to 2.1.1. I'm going to try and dig it out here so I can quote you fairly accurately. The functionality, the requirement is the functionality of the content is operable through a keyboard interface. Keyboard interface, not a keyboard, which sounds weird that I'd make that distinction, but I'll explain in a minute here. All functionality of the content is operable through a keyboard interface without requiring specific timings. The note one, this exception relates to the underlying function, not the input technique. So for example, if using handwriting to enter text, the input technique, handwriting, requires path-dependent input, but the underlying text function, text input, does not. Note two, this does not forbid and should not discourage providing mouse input or other input methods in addition to the keyboard operation. And then if I go take a look at the definition of keyboard interface, because again, it's about the keyboard interface, not the keyboard, the hard keyboard itself. So the quick answer is no, you don't have to add keyboards to things that don't have keyboards in order to make them conforming to WCAG. So keyboard interface used by software, interface used by software to obtain keystroke input. Note one, a keyboard interface allows users to provide keystroke input to programs even if the native technology does not contain a keyboard. And even though this was written back in 2008, WCAG 2.0 anticipated having touchscreen only ICT. So the example here, a touchscreen PDA has a keyboard interface built into its operating system as well as a connector for external keyboards. Applications in the PDA can be used to interface to obtain the keyboard input either from the external keyboard or from other applications that simulate keyboard output. So, you know, all this very technical stuff was incorporated into the WCAG 2.0 document.
Okay. One very specific question. So if one participant wrote, if we can't use red on white for error messages, what should we use?
So the red on white, which again, red on white being a very problematic color combination, you can One thing you can do is you can tweak the hue of red that you're using, so you make that 4.5 to 1 or that 3 to 1 contrast ratio. But the other thing you can do is to use a highlighting color or to use another bright color besides red that does meet the contrast requirement and doesn't have the historic problem for people with certain vision disabilities. I saw another similar question about inactive field elements or something about gray on input. Do we have that?
That was at the very beginning, I think, and I didn't catch that one. Sorry. What color gray do you recommend for hint text so that sighted readers are able to use it?
So if you're putting text on the screen, you want everyone to read it. Now you're probably visually you're trying to differentiate the hint text from, you know, the text that's used for labeling a field element, that kind of thing. Well, you know, developers, designers, you've got a lot of choices there making the text so light that someone with low vision has trouble reading it is probably not the best design choice, and especially if you're not meeting that 3-to-1 contrast requirement of 144, I think is the number, the success criterion. So, use a different color, use a different method of emphasis, use a highlight, inverse the colors. There's lots of design choices one can make and still maintain a decent contrast ratio.
And one question that came in had to do with what are the opportunities for developers and others involved in 508 to work and communicate with others on common problems, like, you know, this question of color contrast and what are the different avenues available for achieving what you want. That really sounds like something that a good community of practice could really dig their teeth into, and there are so many of those. Bruce, are you aware of forums or online communities, either within the federal government or beyond, that people can use for that purpose? Or Tim?
Sure. There's lots of these online forums, and that's one of the really useful things that we've done by harmonizing with WCAG 2.0, this very stable worldwide standard, is that the information you get out of these forums is readily applicable to the needs of the federal government, because there are so many organizations that have standardized to the WCAG 2.0 success criteria. So we've made these forums even wider. Within the federal government, there's a web content managers forum. Outside of the federal government, I'm not even, you know, there's so many different user groups for all different types of applications. It's so much of it is just out there public facing. But in particular, I'm going to advertise some of the resources that are at the W3C. There's a interest group list, there's a guidelines listserv, and a lot of the work that's being done on WCAG 2.1 is being done on GitHub, which is again a mainstream tool. But those interest groups and those guidelines resources are, you know, you're plugged into the people that helped write the WCAG guidelines to get feedback on those things. That's just one of hundreds of resources possibly.
This is Tim. I just want to add, too, that there is one of the things that we're doing during this time before the rule becomes required for all agencies to follow, several agencies are working together to provide implementation suggestions and advice. And so they've created the Section 508 Accessibility Toolkit. We've already mentioned the link. It's at https://, it's found at section508.gov/refresh-toolkit. That's another good place to go to for looking for technical assistance.
Okay, a very specific question about the interplay on the two different audio description requirements and the interplay between success criteria 1.2.3 and 1.2.5. The person writing the question is wondering whether 1.2.5 invalidates 1.2.3 in some way.
That's a great question, and absolutely, we've got, you know, that's a person who's really paying attention there. Okay, so this falls out of WCAG 2.0 addressing different audiences with the different levels. So 1.2.3, which is level A, says audio description or media alternative. 1.2.5 says audio description. So, you know, 1.2.3 is A or B, and 1.2.5 is no, just B. So yes, you satisfy 1.2.3 by doing 1.2.5. So again, in words, 1.2.3 allows you to provide audio description or a media alternative, that's your corrected transcript kind of thing. 1.2.5 says no, for your pre-recorded multimedia, you have to have audio description. So you don't satisfy WCAG level AA, you don't satisfy 508 unless you have the audio description. So the way you meet 1.2.3 is the same way you meet 1.2.5. Thank you for that.
Okay, thank you very much. Another question came in regarding captioning. The question was about captioning of live video, but I'll ask it a little bit more generally. And are there any requirements with respect to accuracy of the captions?
So there are, the FCC and some other groups have been working on metrics for caption quality. That's not a settled standard, if you will. There isn't consensus about what are the right requirements for caption quality, and so we don't have a requirement for caption quality in WCAG 2.0. We don't have that in 508. What I encourage people to do is to get used to the captioning that is provided by mainstream media and in live broadcasts versus pre-recorded broadcasts and pre-recorded movies. Captioning for pre-recorded stuff should be, you know, very, very accurate. The expectation for captioning of live events, say the captioning we're doing on this broadcast, is, you know, much more fluid. So, you know, the captioning, you should expect that when you contract for captioning on a live event, you know, you should be familiar with what that looks like so that you can know that you're getting decent quality for a live event.
Okay. Shifting to a different subject, where can somebody get a color contrast tool?
There's several of those available. You can actually do that, you know, you can do it with a hand calculator, because any tool that has an eyedropper tool as part of it, you can figure out the two colors you're getting. You can plug them in by hand. There's something called the Juices Studio Luminosity Test. It's a nice tool. The Web Accessibility Toolbar has a tool built into it. And then the other thing is, go to the W3C resources or the understanding document. That if you go to WCAG 2.0, go to that success criteria 144, go to understanding 1.4.4, and there'll be a link to online resources for making those calculations.
Okay. Another question has to do with...
I'm sorry, that was the wrong number that I gave.
Oh.
143.
Okay. Another question has to do with agency testing protocols, and the question is whether the testing methodologies used for accessibility used by agencies conforms to the conformance with WCAG 2.0 AA.
So I think that's a reference to trusted tester, Debbie. You think?
Well, I can answer that.
Okay.
Oh, I can try. There's no specific required testing methodology within the federal government, and so agencies, there's no set methodology. Every agency can decide what methodology they're going to use themselves. And agencies with more mature programs tend to have a defined methodology for testing that is more mature than, say, seeing whether somebody with a screen reader can use something, because that certainly is not a complete methodology. The trusted tester methodology, which was developed by the Department of Homeland Security and is now training for which is available online, is conformant with WCAG 2.0. They're working on making sure that it's fully harmonized with the refresh standards. And there may be a few details where it will need to be tweaked. That methodology is probably a very useful one, because there's a training already provided. The protocol and methodology is set and available for people, and an agency doesn't have to create their own testing methodology.
Thanks, Debbie. The other thing I'll add to that is that, you know, if you use the built-in accessibility checkers for, say, Microsoft Word or Adobe Acrobat, those accessibility checkers have all been tuned to WCAG 2.0, and they started to do that back in 2008 once WCAG 2.0 was standard. So, and then if you go to checklists about how to make your Word document accessible or how to make your PDF accessible, they're all about, you know, how do you do accessibility generally? Here are all the things we know how to do to make your Word document accessible. Here are all the things we know to make your PDF document accessible. So by virtue of trying to address the particular media type, they're already addressing all the things that are applicable to WCAG 2L.
Okay, so let me see what else we've got. And an interesting technical question, how should a developer handle special characters for accessibility, especially for screen readers?
This is Bruce again. I don't think you have to do anything in particular for your, anything you can, well, that's not true, anything you can enter from the keyboard. Anything in the extended regular character set will have, a modern screen reader will have a pronunciation rules for that. So you don't have to worry about avoiding things like ampersands or the example is a caret mark. I'm not sure about that one. If you're in a different language, that's an issue. If you're using a emoji kind of thing, if you're using ASCII art, those are an issue. But most of everything you can type off the regular keyboard without, you know, having to go switch your keyboard set, your off-the-shelf commercially available screen reading software is going to handle that no problem.
Okay. Maybe one more quick question. A few people asked about automatic testing tools, and one person wanted to know what we recommended. I think I'll amend that to how can agencies find out about automatic testing tools and to make their own decisions about whether to use one and which one, what to look for.
Well, the I will reemphasize that the success criteria are all written so that they're objectively testable, but that doesn't mean they're testable by these testing tools, by machines, by software code. That they are testable by different subject matter experts should give the same answer as to if a certain piece of content satisfies the success criteria or not. But the testing tools are limited, and the example I always love to give for this is, even with something as simple as alternative text, the testing tool can tell you if it's missing alternative text. It can do an algorithm to find, like, if you're using a file name or something, but it can't tell you if the alternative text, the text equivalent, the descriptive identification, it can't say if that's any good. That's very much a human kind of subjective evaluation, and we can have, a large range of subject matter experts that agree on that, but it's not going to be something that's actually machine testable for the foreseeable future. There are a number of commercially available products, I think you were saying, Debbie. There's also a lot of number of free ones. I don't want to try and say it this moment in time off the top of my head because I'm going to skip some that are, great.
The Web Accessibility Initiative, if you go to the WCAG 2.0, the website where you find WCAG 2.0, there's an awful lot of information there about the different kinds of tools that are available and about whether and how to use them. So that's
w3.org/WAI.
Right. Okay, so we've run out of time for questions. Let's go on to the last slide. To contact us for more information, contact the U.S. Access Board. Phone number is 800-872-2253 for voice, 800-993-2822 for TTY. Email is 508@access-board.gov. And the website, which we've already given a few times, is www.access-board.gov. So that ends this webinar. We thank you again and would like to remind you the next scheduled session is May 30th, where we will be looking at a more detailed comparison of the old standards compared to the new ones. Thank you very much. And you can register for May 30th now at www.adaconferences.org/CIOC. Thank you very, very much.
That concludes today's webinar.